Welcome back to SF Live. Thank you for joining us here today. And today we're doing something different. We're breaking a bit out of our own echo chamber here of gold and precious metals and silver investments. Enough talking about the silver squeeze for this week. Let's talk about something else. Let's talk about oil. And admittedly, like oil and gas, or oil primarily today, is not an area that I'm an absolute expert in. So I'm really curious and really excited, actually, to have Rory Johnston on. He's the founder of CommodityContext.com, a really interesting Substack newsletter, and a fantastic Twitter follow as well, at Rory_Johnston. So make sure to follow him there. But we're going to shed some light on what is happening in the supply and demand side of oil and crude, with a bit of a focus of the U.S., 50% of our audience is U.S.-based, so I'm sure the information will be helpful and educational, obviously not investment advice, but just financial education. So we hope you find it interesting, and if you do, follow us on YouTube, follow us on Twitter, hit that like and subscribe button, especially that like button helps us get noticed by other investors as well, or by other like-minded people like yourself, to sort of find our channel and find the great content that we produce. And now, without further ado, I'm looking forward to this. Rory, thank you for joining us. Good morning to you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, great pleasure. Like, I've come across your Twitter account a couple of times, and lots of smart people follow you as well, and there must be something to it. So great to have you on, and really appreciate it. And thanks for helping me break out of my own little world here.
I'm always happy to talk for far too long about oil. I'm sure my wife appreciates a different outlet.
Fantastic. Yeah, let's tire you out a little bit
exactly.
Before I let you go again. But Rory, it's your first time on SF Live, and why don't you give us a brief history of yourself and a bit of background, and then we can sort of dive into what is going on in the world.
Yeah, so my background, so I used to work leading commodity economics research at Scotiabank here in Toronto, where I'm based. So I'm Canadian. At the beginning of 2020, I left Scotiabank to do something on the family office side. And then obviously COVID hit, markets everywhere went completely insane. And I think, you know, particularly true in commodity markets, both on the downside initially with crude, you know, briefly trading for negative prices on a WTI basis for the first time in history in April of 2020. And then basically from that point, almost a straight line rise back up to some of the highest levels the oil market has seen in its history, kind of briefly almost getting back up to as high as we saw during the kind of mega price spike of 2008. So during that kind of, kerfuffle, the noise around that, I kept getting calls from media and kind of people being like, what's going on? And I was shocked that there weren't more people talking about oil in public in an informed manner. So I kind of took that as my sign that I should try and start something of my own. So I started Commodity Context, which can be found on Substack and at commoditycontext.com. And there is, it's my attempt at the type of research I was doing at Scotiabank, but for a much broader audience and kind of completely my creation. And I can kind of control all the different pieces of the analysis and the forecast. So it's been a bit of a dream for me. And I've been really, really excited with how it's been going. So we've covered, you know, everything from, you know, it started, it would have been June 2021. And at that stage, obviously, you know, crude was still, well below 100. I think at that stage, we were probably around like the 60s. But basically from that point, all the way straight up to the invasion of Ukraine from Russia, the market had been kind of marching in a very singular direction. So my hope was to kind of disentangle and decompose what's driving those prices higher. What can we expect, and kind of inform people a little bit more generally about the types of things that drive the oil market on a daily basis?
Yeah, fantastic. By the way, I love the domain commoditycontext.com.
Thank you so much.
So catchy. It just makes so much sense. Like, as a bit of a marketing nerd, I guess, like, I absolutely love it. So congrats on that. So just
fantastic.
As a side
thank
note,
you so much. So,
fantastic. I'll never forget that one. But yeah, you mentioned like there's a kerfuffle going on. And I think the volatility that I'd call it volatility, but hasn't seized. And it's quite interesting because, as you said, we've pretty much ran up in a straight line to $120 a barrel. And then we dropped off like 50% down to $80. And now... Yeah. Today we're trading at about $87, $88 a barrel. What has, like, I don't know, it's like, I'm not sure how to like phrase that question actually, but
what happened?
Like, why is it so extremely volatile?
Yeah. Right? So I think the starting there is, I think, a really good point. So I've been in the oil industry for about a decade now. I started in the industry about 2012. And for the entirety of my career, so I'm what you'd call in the industry a barrel counter. I'm someone that likes to build global supply-demand balances, trying to figure out exactly in any given quarter how much more crude there's going to be than we need, or on the other side, a deficit of crude. So I count these barrels. So it's all about kind of accounting and forecasting and trying to figure out where things are going and where things are, I think, most importantly today. In any given moment, basically straight up through to the beginning of COVID, when you were talking about, you know, differences in opinion or differences in forecasts, you were typically talking, you know, a couple hundred thousand barrels a day here or there, maybe a million barrels a day on the global headline level between forecasts, on an extreme basis. So that's your kind of normal deviation in forecast. And just, you know, to put in perspective, the oil market globally consumes roughly, for ease in this conversation, about 100 million barrels a day. So the math is really easy, right? You know, supply and demand imbalances very rarely get above or below 1-2% of the global supply base. During COVID, all of that normality completely out the window. And now we're talking about major kind of million to 2 million or even 3 million barrel a day kind of forecast differences or jumps around in the data in all the, you know, not just the global level, but like each major component of the supply demand balance. So we had, you know, US production had been rip roaring and reliably voracious for so long. And then COVID came along and completely changed how the US shale patch responded to higher prices. So that's a major forecast change that alone would have been the thing to obsess over for analysts, you know, for an entire year. But then you also had OPEC kind of running, it was running into its end of, its productive capacity as it was bringing back its, the cuts that had balanced the market in 2020. Then you had Russia that obviously invaded Ukraine and completely changed, you know, for a brief period, the IEA was forecasting that Russia was going to, its supply was going to fall off by 3 million barrels a day, which alone would have been a larger supply deficit than virtually any kind of period, you know, in the decade preceding COVID. And then on top of all that, you had the COVID effects and in the kind of latest iteration, the extreme volatility of Chinese demand, which, you know, between February and April dropped by about 3 million barrels a day as well. So these are massive, massive changes on the fundamental side that I think actually fundamentally justify the financial price volatility that we're seeing, which is rare because you normally, when you hear about volatility, you think, it's traders, it's speculators, they're just making noise out of nothing. But I actually think what we're seeing is very, very kind of haphazard, you know, granted, but price discovery nonetheless. And I think, you know, that's what we're seeing right now. And that's the challenge is like, that's just how weird things are at the moment.
I'm shocked that supply and demand still trickles down to the physical price of something, actually. Again, being caught in my old gold and silver bubble here, right? Where supply and demand doesn't really have an impact, apparently.
Exactly.
But no, that is really interesting to hear because like forecasting is almost impossible in that case because there's so many macro events happening at the same time that you just pretty much can't. Right?
Yeah, exactly. And there's no real, you know, it's impossible to come down with a high confidence base case scenario. And I think at the end of the day, it's all scenarios. So, you know, you have to choose, you know, where's OPEC going to be? Where's shale going to be? You know, is Russia going to continue to be able to displace its exports from, you know, Germany to India? You know, can that happen? And can that continue to happen? And you need to kind of take a position on each of those, which because everyone has to take a position, that means there's a lot of kind of ground between, I think, reasonable forecasts in the market right now.
Fantastic. Absolutely. I'm stunned a bit. It's really interesting. Completely different world for me, admittedly, right? So, but one thing I've noticed, and I read a headline actually this morning in the news here, I think it was on Reuters, was that the Permian Basin is actually hitting record production. And that brought me back to some headlines I've seen a couple of years ago where it says, well, the U.S. has been pretty much or is energy independent as the U.S. is now, used to be an oil exporter or exporting country, not an importer anymore. How has that changed in the overall like global schematic?
Yeah. So, I mean, what's interesting, so U.S. shale, and I think it's important for people that aren't familiar with the oil industry to kind of understand the main difference between shale and what we'll call kind of tight oil. And the majority of the rest of oil supply. And the main difference is the speed at which the supply can come online to the market. Instead of years, upwards of a decade for some projects in traditional markets, let's say like, you know, deep sea offshore or the Canadian oil sands, U.S. shale can come on in a matter of, months, which is very, very fast. But the difference is that it also declines very, very quickly. So if you stop investment, it's like a treadmill. You eventually just kind of fall off and decline, and the decline rates take over and supply kind of falls off, which is why during COVID, you saw some of the largest declines anywhere in the world in the United States, because, when price went negative, obviously everyone stopped investing. And then all of a sudden those decline rates kicked in, and then you lost, two and a half, almost three, I think at the peak, million barrels of crude out of the U.S. supply stack. Today, we actually still are not back at pre-COVID levels for U.S. production. And a big part of that is, what you are seeing is any of the production growth now is coming almost uniformly and kind of purely in the Permian Basin, whereas you have seen other basins kind of take a step back, conventional take a step back, et cetera. And I think that's the kind of dual nature of U.S. oil right now is it's kind of the Permian Basin versus the rest. And the Permian Basin is growing extremely fast. I think the other thing that's important to understand for people is that, just to put in perspective of how voracious the growth in U.S. shale was during that period from like 2014 to the beginning of the pandemic. It was the fastest kind of production growth that we'd ever seen in the history of the oil market, frankly. In 2018, when Brent was trading at $60 a barrel on average, U.S. supply growth, U.S. supply grew by something like 2 million barrels a day year over year, which was more than global demand grew in that year. So U.S. alone required, and that's when OPEC cut to try and balance that offset. Now, with oil well over $100 on average for the year, U.S. shale is kind of growing in that 1 million barrel a day range. And that's total liquids. That's including natural gas liquids. That's including everything else. Crude's even lower, probably more like 700,000, 800,000 barrels. So I think that's the difference. But when people, it's hard for people to understand sometimes that U.S. is still growing faster than anywhere else. And there's really no competition, but it's growing at half the pace it used to. And that's the big difference in this market.
Interesting. Okay, so that's sort of my next question. Like, I sort of know the answer to now based on what you just mentioned, but one thing that kept popping up in the news as well, and President Biden was quite vocal about it, was releasing some of the strategic petroleum reserves in the U.S. to sort of keep gasoline prices or gas prices at a lower level. So how does that fit together then? Because I don't think refining capacity disappeared. That wasn't the problem. But where's the connection there? Maybe connect it for us and to try to make sense of the SPR, so Strategic Petroleum Reserve, versus, we got growing production, actually.
Yeah, so, this is really interesting, right? And I'll wrap back to the refining side, but we actually did lose a lot of refining capacity.
Oh, okay.
In a separate, so with the oil market, the crude markets had a crisis, and the refining markets had an entirely separate crisis that we can also talk about, and is kind of periodically rearing its head right now. But just to dwell on the SPR, which is something that I've written about extensively at Commodity Context, because I'm kind of a nerd about the SPR, because it's a fascinating, kind of fairly unique feature of the oil market. And this release, which is the largest release from the SPR in history by a long shot, when you look at historical releases from the SPR, they are typically more like, a couple 10, 20, 30 million barrels of release, to offset a temporary disruption in Gulf of Mexico production from a hurricane. That's normally what the SPR has been used for historically. This is 180 million barrels over 180 days. So it's an incremental supply addition to the market, averaging about a million barrels a day of supply, which is equal to the entire UK offshore production industry, is just the US SPR function right now. So what's interesting about that is that it is completely discretionary. It has no bearing really on, the drawdown of the SPR is purely a policy choice. The Biden administration decided to embark upon the SPR release when the market was, by all indications, exceptionally historically tight, with prices up above 120 and calendar spreads, which is something we'll talk about later in terms of the shape of the futures curve. But calendar spreads in the curve were indicating exceptionally tight spot markets. So all of that looked really, really good. And I think I'm in the camp that actually thinks that the SPR release was actually the right policy choice at that particular moment. The irony, however, is that they kind of set it and forget it, right? It's a release for 6 months, and that's they kind of pre-communicated this. And I think transparency and communication is good. The challenge is that the oil market does not stay the same for 6 months. And what we've seen is that obviously prices are now below 90, and you know, calendar spreads in the spot market are actually kind of veering close to signals of oversupply for the first time since the beginning of the pandemic. And I think it's actually one of these moments where I personally, if I was SPR czar, if you will, and you know, Biden, please give me a call. I think that that's the kind of thing that I would be stopping the SPR release right now, because I think that now you're adding just more supply on top of what already looks like an oversupplied market. And all that's going to do is kind of depress the intention to invest in U.S. shale patch and the organic production side. You're going to depress that, and then you're going to have to pay for that back later. We've already seen, for instance, like, you know, you were mentioning the Permian Basin. We've actually seen for the last couple of weeks, the rig count or the number of rigs that are drilling horizontal wells in the Permian Basin have actually fallen back over the past couple of weeks, which is kind of an early sign that maybe the growth there is going to slow slightly from what we would have had if prices stayed above $100. So I think this is the challenge. I think the correct criticism of the SPR release is that you're kind of, you know, you're mortgaging the future because, you know, you're selling those barrels and you don't have it for the future. And I think it's a correct policy choice if you're doing it for a very specific time-bounded reason. And as I've written extensively at Commodity Context, I think the correct policy course was not just to sell crude, but to sell and then instantly buy it back in the future. So you're guaranteeing that you get those barrels back. You're pushing down the front of the futures curve, which is the spot prices that we all experience at the pump, while at the same time pulling up the back of the futures curve, which is the price that investors and oil companies see when trying to sanction kind of new investment. So that's the Goldilocks scenario. And we've seen initial progress towards the Biden administration trying to do that. You've seen proposed rule changes, and there's kind of a comment period right now. And I think there's progress towards that. But as of yet, we haven't seen it. And I think that's the problem, is we're only seeing the selling right now. And I think that is, you know, it risks being in a kind of a bad policy scenario.
Interesting. Like, an interesting thought came to mind. And I had to think of the letter the Exxon CEO sent to Biden complaining about, like, well, you want us to stop invest, or you want us to invest more, but you're not really enticing us to do so.
Yes.
And but that's more on the front end. But what you're saying now, and again, I'm trying to be smarter than I am probably, but what it sounds like in the back end now, like doing this, keeping the SPR release alive, is sort of, as you said, pulling up the forward curve there, or the future curve, is sort of guaranteeing higher prices in the future without saying so, right? Saying, okay, we're buying this back later, but we're not publicly communicating that we're subsidizing what you're doing.
Yeah, well, and I think that's the thing, is they've said they're going to buy it back. My point is they don't need to just say it. They can actually just do it. They can go in and contract and buy futures contracts. And that would have actually, no kind of communication needed. It would have transmitted the signal into the market. And I think there were rules that made it difficult for them to do that, prior to this crisis. And I think the benefit is that coming out of this, I think we're going to have a much more flexible SPR policy framework with which to deal with future crises. But I think this one, you know, as in all things, policy moves slow, the oil market moves fast. And this is kind of we're catching ourselves a little flat-footed. There's even been musings that the Biden administration would consider a larger or extended release of the SPR, which as of right now, I think is actually definitely not needed based on the market that we're seeing. But ironically, could actually be needed by the end of the year if the SPR falls off, if OPEC production stops being added. And we lose Russian supply, China bounces back, et cetera, et cetera. All of those big kind of volatile moving pieces I talked about can also swing back in that bullish direction. That's the whole, challenge with the volatility we're seeing.
What I was trying to hint at with the Exxon letter as well, because exploration is expensive, investments in refining capacity and various things are really expensive, especially building a new refinery. It takes years and billions of dollars. So the price certainty, like with the SPR, like having to buy back in the futures market, like does that guarantee the producers a certain price minimum?
Yeah, that's right?
So that's what I mean by the backdoor sort of like sector subsidies, but like it's a backdoor guarantee that at least prices will stay stable so the producers can actually make those investments that Biden demanded.
That's exactly it. Because when you buy, let's say, a futures contract for, you know, delivery October 2024, let's say, someone else is selling that contract. And theoretically, that someone is someone that is hedging their own production out the future. So I think that is actually, that's exactly, I think, the goal. And then even if you are Exxon and you didn't actually sell that barrel, you can see that the future kind of dated prices are rising or are an acceptable level. And you could hedge if you wanted to.
Okay. Showing my naivety again, like how far in the future can you trade? How far do the future contracts go?
You know, you could go 5 years. It really now the liquidity kind of drops off very quickly that far out the curve. I don't think that there's much of a useful signal in the curve beyond, let's say, 3 years forward. But this is actually a great opportunity to kind of talk about the futures curve, because I think it's a really, really interesting kind of financial instrument and kind of reality in the market. And it's also something I think that gets chronically misunderstood by people that aren't familiar with how the physical market clears through the futures curve, because a lot of people are very, very used to purely financial instruments that have no physical kind of component to them. They don't have storage costs, they don't have transportation costs, et cetera. But crude is obviously extraordinarily physical. And at the end of the day, the market always needs to clear in the spot market. And that's what drives the entire shape of the futures curve. So the classic, I think, misunderstanding of the market is when the futures curve is lower today than it is in the future, that, you know, the assumption is that the quote market's forecast for the price of crude is that it will go up, which is actually the exact opposite of what you should be taking from the futures curve at that moment. Because what a upward sloping curve means, or when the curve is what we call in contango, it means that there's a, you know, increasing discount on spot cargoes of crude because the spot market is oversupplied and you need to pay to store those barrels somewhere. So what that does is anyone that has spare inventory space, that person can buy a barrel in the spot market, sell it instantly forward, and basically pocket, let's say, $10 a barrel if they hold it for a year. And then they basically, you know, the arbitrage is the difference in their storage cost and financing costs and that trade. And that is effectively how the market clears. So when you have extreme bouts of oversupply, like we saw at the beginning of 2020, or you saw at the beginning, you know, in the bottom of the oil price collapse in 2016, you saw something called super contango, which is kind of like, you know, you're basically paying for a year forward something like $20, $25 a barrel, which actually justifies traders chartering super tankers, filling them with crude and just floating them off the coast and waiting for a year. That's what's fun about the futures curve is that it always needs to clear the market. And it's your kind of clearest signal as to what's happening in the spot market, particularly in a market when a market where most data is lagged by at minimum a month or two. You have some weekly data, but most of the data is on a fundamental basis lagged. The opposite of that is called backwardation, when the curve is downward sloping. Now, that is, again, the misconception is, oh, okay, that means that the market thinks that the price is going to fall, which in one tiny way is true. But predominantly what it's saying is that right now it's really, really tight in the spot market, and you're actually introducing an opportunity cost for holders of inventory to not sell their barrels. Because then you could basically do the inverse trade. You could basically sell a barrel and buy the exact same barrel back in 6 months. And, you know, there's actually no storage costs. You're not doing anything. You're just lending the barrel to the market and you're getting paid for it. And so on both sides, that's how the futures market, futures curve clears the spot market. And I think what it you know, the calendar spread, or the, you know, the basically a measure of how steep the curve is at any given point. Basically, the difference between, let's say, you know, the prompt contract and the contract for delivery 12 months in the future, you know, that is a great signal for how over or undersupplied the market is at any given point. So during the kind of entirety of the run-up of crude prices over the last 18 months, the market has been exceptionally backwardated. It has hit record backwardation on a bunch of different metrics. But ever since prices kind of collapsed in, you know, early June, we've seen the market kind of almost basically flatten right out. The curve is very, very flat right now. You still do have backwardation, but it's far less extreme. And I think what you've seen there is that's mostly because the demand side of the market has really, really fallen apart, both on a kind of a general macro malaise basis. But I think most acutely what we were saying earlier about China, that, you know, China as of April started going on these rolling COVID zero lockdowns of larger and larger portions of their economy. And that took a huge amount of demand into the market. And so what we're seeing right now is that demand continues to march forward, but supply continues to march forward, but demand has fallen back to meet it for the first time since the initial oversupply at the beginning of 2020.
Interesting. Like you mentioned oversupply. It was a note I made here. You were talking about oversupplied market, and I was trying to figure out like how much of it is also seasonality. Obviously, in the summer in the Northern Hemisphere, we need less oil and gas because we don't heat as much, obviously. U.S., usually a lot of gas is used, or diesel is used during the summer because everybody drives everywhere in the summer, right? How did that fit together? Is it really just China disappearing, or like what other factors are sort of fitting into the, like, I'm looking at 8760 right now, like into the price collapse of oil over the summer?
Yeah, so I would say that, you know, it's fun, and all of the normal seasonal patterns are also a little bit funny right now, not least because of the energy crisis going on in Europe. So I think the challenge that we're, you know, normally in a normal market, let's say prior to COVID, the market was typically globally strongest in the summer and weakest in the winter. And the reason for that is that the, particularly the US driving season is just so robust. And, you know, you get, and the travel season in Europe and everyone's flying and going on vacation, et cetera, et cetera. You also have things like Saudi Arabia burns direct crude oil to produce electricity to help, generate electricity for the kingdom's air conditioning needs in the summer because it's exceptionally hot in the desert in the summer. So all that together, you know, that, you know, summer used to be the boon time for crude. Now, however, less people are flying generally. So that kind of feature is lessened. At the same time, going into the winter, there's a large and I think very realistic expectation that given the exceptionally high price of natural gas in Europe, in many cases, it's cheaper to burn diesel or kerosene or whatever else. Excuse me. In direct generation or in home heating rather than gas. And I think that, what you're seeing is like gas to liquids demand shifting. So I think there's been in this year, we're going to see a bit of an opposite kind of seasonal factor there. And I think that's going to be larger than the kind of typical driving season. But really ever since COVID, all of the normal seasonal patterns have kind of got completely wonky. And I think nothing is as reliable as it used to be.
Interesting. Okay, so all we know is we know nothing, actually.
Like, yeah, exactly, right?
Perfect. We can end it right here, and everybody's like, yeah. Really interesting. Okay, let's bring it back to today as well. Like, what is happening today? We're recording this on September 13th, just a couple hours after the U.S. CPI numbers came out, and I'm trying to build a bit of context around that as well because I'm just looking at a really red screen. S&P is down, Dow is down, Nasdaq is down, Russell 2000 is down, and of course, crude oil is down. Right. And so how does that fit all together? 8.3% was the inflation number year over year. For me, that's still a very high number, but seems like everybody's cheering. It's like, oh, it's coming down. It's steadying. And the rate hikes seem to be working. But how is oil impacted by that number?
Yeah. And I actually think, you know, my Twitter screen right now is, I think, singing a slightly different tune. I think the big concern with this print, and I think everyone was hoping, I think, you know, you had seen signs that inflationary pressure, particularly in North America, were easing. And then this print, I think, really kind of dashed some kind of cold water on that because it was, while it was, you know, lower on that year-on-year basis, you did see, I think it was a 0.6% month-on-month core CPI gain. I think that's the big concern now. So obviously crude and gasoline prices have fallen off. I think gasoline prices in the thing were in the report were down more than 10%. So, you know, the headline, the oil impact is lesser now, but you know, the real kind of organic inflationary pressure, particularly in the US economy, I think is actually more pronounced than particularly Chairman Powell was hoping. So I think now the concern is, okay, well now, you know, I should be clear, I'm not a central bank watcher. I'm not an interest rate guy, but you know, the consensus seems to be, well, 75 basis point hike at the next meeting seems like a lock now. And I think what you're seeing is that's not great for growth. That's not great for aggregate demand. And that's the point, right? Is that they're trying to pull that down. And I think it makes sense that you see risk assets like equities and crude kind of falling off together in that kind of environment. I think it's also, you know, it's important to note that, you know, one of the things I think is very unique about this moment in global macro is that, again, for most of my career, the macro cycle has been very synchronized. Countries have kind of come up and down together on effectively the same credit cycle. You know, it's been reasonably orderly, not a lot of major economy differences kind of, you know, that are driving the ship. Now, however, the US and I think Canada are in this situation where I think you do have legitimate signs of excess demand and kind of an overheated potential labor market. Whereas in Europe, you also have an inflationary crisis, but it's for entirely different reasons. It's because of Russian energy and it's because of all these other things. So then at the same time, you have China, which is having an entirely different crisis. And I think that's what's interesting is that you have all the major centers of economic power experiencing different bouts of kind of, you know, differently prompted inflationary pressure. And they're all dealing with it in slightly different ways. But overall, the effect is tighter monetary policy conditions, you know, attempts to tamp down aggregate demand, even in Europe, even if the main problem there isn't labor kind of tightness, it's energy. That doesn't stop the ECB from kind of hiking rates. So this is the challenge right now is, you know, no one really knows where or when, you know, any one of these pieces is going to slip. And I think that's the worry right now, particularly for something like crude is, okay, well, you know, Europe's a big economy. You know, China's a massive economy for crude. You know, it doesn't consume as much crude as the United States, but the growth in crude consumption is overwhelmingly dominant. So there was a piece that came out a couple of days ago, I think it was yesterday, excuse me, that basically noted that the Chinese economy looks like, unless something turns around very, very quickly in the next month or two, is set for the first annual contraction of oil demand in over two decades, which is, you know, it's a major thing. Normally it's growing by 300, 400, 500 plus thousand barrels a day every year. And that's very, very reliable demand. And if this year, it's not going to collapse, but I think it's, you know, the latest numbers, it looks like it's going to fall by like 50 or 100,000 barrels a day, which is, again, just directionally wrong for what the market is used to. So I think all that together, this kind of inflation environment, this kind of monetary policy environment is not particularly conducive to crude demand, which it will fundamentally be the thing that pushes us higher. I think on a more structural basis, on a longer term, after we get out of this kind of period of crisis, I think the bigger concern on crude on the crude market is supply. I think that, you know, you don't have a lot of major future areas of supply growth. You basically have the US, you have Canada, you have new discoveries in Guyana, and you have some supply in Brazil. But outside of that, you're not going to have a huge amount of growth many other places around the world right now, at least not expected. And that I think is the reality that will eventually take hold. But right now we're in a demand trap. And I think that, you know, demand and policy rates rule everything around me right now.
Really interesting environment we're in. Maybe as a last question, as sort of to wrap it up and maybe understand some more context as well. Like
me as a novice.
So yeah, exactly. Commodity context, right? Putting some context for the retail investor around what is happening in this space. Because a lot of investors follow billionaire investor Warren Buffett, right?
Yeah.
And what he's doing. He's invested over $25 billion in Chevron and Occidental Petroleum. Like, what is he chasing there? He's obviously no dummy. What is he looking for in a definitely interesting environment, like where you expect, like, there might be some discrepancies moving forward, at least for the short term?
Yeah, and I think that I should be my preface here is that I'm really not an equity level researcher, and I haven't studied Buffett's dealings with Occidental in detail. But generally, I think what we do know about Buffett is that he's a very patient man, and he looks at fundamentals above all else. And I think what you see there is Occidental is a company that has a very, very dominant position in the U.S. Permian Basin, which we've been discussing, which is, you know, by all intents and purposes, going to be the future of kind of it is the present and will continue to be the future of U.S. crude production. And we're going to be in that scenario where after we get through this temporary, albeit awful, kind of macro environment, then we get back into that scenario that I was talking about where supply matters most. And I think in that kind of environment where the U.S. shale patch is not growing at a kind of capital destructive rate like it used to. And I think, again, just for people that don't follow, that haven't followed the market for the past decade, in the decade preceding COVID, U.S. shale growth was so voracious and was so unprofitable that depending on the numbers you use, somewhere between the U.S. shale patch burned between $300 and $500 billion. Again, $500 trillion on unproductive, unprofitable kind of supply growth. And I think that's the kind of thing that investors don't want to see again. And I think what we've seen coming out of COVID is that there is this capital discipline. There is this kind of prioritization of shareholder return. And that's the kind of company that I think is very interesting to someone like Buffett who wants cash flow. And it seems like these, and what you're seeing is all of these oil producers right now are printing cash. And I think that the biggest concern right now for these companies is actually not even, I mean, obviously there's China and there's the near term kind of price stuff. But I think the concern is, if they maintain discipline and prices stay really, really high and they're making ungodly gobs of money, we're already seeing pressure in Europe for windfall profit taxes and kind of, you know, excess profit levies and everything of the sort that, you know, okay, well, this seems unfair. And I think it's, you know, this kind of narrative, this kind of concern really grates on oil investors, and I think not unreasonably, because it doesn't seem fair, right? You know, Apple and Amazon are making ungodly gobs of money every day, but their products, you know, make us feel good. Whereas when the oil companies are making gobs of money, it's because you and I are having to spend, you know, $100 or $150 to fill up the family car, and it's hurting us at home. So I think that's just the unfortunate political reality. I think the biggest concern now is, what are our governments going to continue to press on that? We haven't seen it really so far in North America, but we've definitely seen it in Europe. And the question is, you know, like fashion trends, what starts in Europe doesn't always stay in Europe.
Now, Paris is not the capital anymore. Definitely not for oil prices and ESG exactly. Policies, right? So, no, fantastic. Rory, what a fantastic conversation. Really,
thank
really
you so much
appreciate
for having
your
me.
Time. It was phenomenal. Where can we find more about you? I think I mentioned it in the intro, but like, what's the best way to reach you?
Yeah, so I mean, the best way to reach me always is on Twitter, where I'm spending far, far too much of my time. I'm at @Rory_Johnston. And you can also find all of my research at commoditycontext.com, or if you just Google Commodity Context or search on the Substack platform, I come up pretty quickly. So again, thank you for having me, and it was a fantastic conversation.
No, I really appreciate it. I learned a lot, so I hope our listeners did as well, and I'm sure they did. So thank you so much for your time. It's much appreciated. And everybody else, thank you so much for joining us. We hope you enjoyed the conversation over here with Rory, and please give him a follow on Twitter. Take a look at his Substack newsletter. It's fantastic content, really, really smartly written as well. And give him a like, give him a follow, obviously. And give us a like and a follow if you like the content and the conversation. It's a bit of a out of the ordinary talking oil and gas, or primarily oil, actually, we did, and demand and supply here as well. And to me, learning about contangos, which is really interesting. It's not a dance. It has to do with oil pricing and some backwardation as well. I learned a lot. I hope you did as well. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back with more very soon. Thank you.